Victoria Woodhull is easily one of the most interesting people in American history. Along with her sister, Tenny Claflin, she took America by storm in the 1870s. She preached insanely radical and progressive sexual politics with a style of oratory that was, by all accounts, an incredible thing to listen to and behold. She was the first woman to speak to Congress on the subject of women's suffrage. She and her sister were the first female stockbrokers on Wall Street. And she was the first woman to run for president, decades before women would even be given the right to vote. She advocated for women's sexual pleasure, women's right to their own bodies and to divorce their husbands, and the decriminalization of prostitution. And she did it all under the influence and guidance of supernatural forces. She was, by her own admission, both a spiritualist medium and, at the height of her fame, she began promoting distinctly occultist ideas. I love Victoria Woodhull. She's one of my favorite people, and her career really helps us to dig into the mystical overlap of subversive politics and supernatural power to bring about women's empowerment. Today, we're going to try to make sense of one particular speech she gave, articulating her grandest and highest spiritually inspired vision of the social elevation of women and the union of the sexes. She gave this speech at the top of her fame, which just so happened to be the end of her public career. It was called The Elixir of Life, and promised its listeners that they could bring about an apocalypse, blending the spiritual and terrestrial worlds into one perfect union of souls, and allowing all people on Earth to literally become immortal. It's crazy ambitious and crazy fascinating, so let's go ahead and get going as we work to elicit Victoria Woodhull's occult confession. My name's Rob Thompson. I'm here with Olivia Litterall.
Hey.
I am the Supreme Hierophant. Olivia is the Grand Master of our Secret Order of Alchemical Actors. You found our podcast here where I have gathered together some students of the occult. I am, I guess for our purposes here, a professor of the occult, and we talk about some major historical figures in the history of occultism.
Yeah, we do. Just thought I should be your hype man. Back you up, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we're all here.
Just trying to hype up Rob.
Just trying to be Rob's hype man.
You're giving away the whole scheme.
Oh. This is... You don't find out about this until the next season.
So also joining our conversation today, we've got Shannon Landers.
Hello.
Anna Pavon.
Hi.
And James Kaplangis.
Howdy, folks.
So, actually, Olivia, you're going to be playing Victoria Woodhull for us today. So we're gonna send you off now to put on your 19th century duds.
Is it just in the back there?
Yeah, the hoop. Mind the hoop, and the whalebone is a little rough on the corset.
Yikes! Okay.
But Savannah will help you tie that tight enough.
All right, Savannah, ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. Bye, guys.
Nice Rick knowing you.
Dying?
you don't come back from this.
This is Occult Confessions. We, the members of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors, do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it. We'll get that right someday.
I felt like I was doing pretty good for a while, and it just skipped a part.
All right. So let's get to know who Woodhull was and where she came from. The greatest source of information comes from Theodore Tilton, a one-time close friend of Woodhull's, who published a biography in the form of a pamphlet in 1872, when public curiosity about her was at its peak. She was born in Berlin Heights, Ohio, on September the 23rd, 1838. Tilton described her infancy and childhood as swaddled in respectable poverty, although she was worked like a slave and whipped like a convict. I think that's... Some of you have described your upbringing that way to me, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Calls out on this podcast.
Yeah. Nobody wants to talk about it?
No.
This is your chance.
Told you in confidence.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I thought maybe you'd want to get it out there. And...
I'm just offended you use my direct quotes.
You're supposed to be getting dressed.
Oh, sorry. I heard bad childhood and came out.
Her father was abusive, and her mother had strong bipolar tendencies, and her whole family, except for Woodhull herself and her sister Tenny, evidently suffered from the same mental disease. During the period of her fame, they relied on her for money, but oddly slandered her in the press and brought her to court while continuing to leech off of her success. Tilton had a nice way of describing her relationship with her family.
Victoria's a green leaf, and her legion of relatives are caterpillars who devour her. Their sin is that they return no thanks after meat. They curse the hand that feeds them.
She only attended school for about 3 years, which is not so strange for a country girl before the standardization of public education. But she received additional tutoring from the spirit realm. She had a 25-year-old nurse by the name of Rachel Scribner who died, and on that day her spirit came to fetch Victoria and carry her off to the spirit world, where she witnessed apocalyptic visions of hell on earth, resurrection, and utopia, and she learned that she could be instrumental in the changing of the world. At 14, Woodhull became seriously ill and was attended by a doctor named Canning Woodhull, who proposed marriage. Anxious to get away from her family, who were equally anxious to bring a doctor into the family, she agreed. But Woodhull turned out to be a womanizer and a drunk. He spent most of his time in brothels and delivered their first child while in a half-drunk stupor.
In 15 months after her marriage, while living in a little low-frame house in Chicago in the dead of winter, with icicles clinging to her bedpost, and attended only by her half-drunk husband, she brought forth in almost mortal agony her firstborn child. Her child, begotten in drunkenness and born in squalor, was a half-idiot, predestined to be a hopeless imbecile for life.
Immediately after delivering the baby, Canning went out drinking again. Victoria sat bleeding on the bed for hours before dragging herself to the wall of her subdivided house and banging on the wall to rouse her neighbor to come over and assist her. She wasn't sure if Canning's poor medical performance at the birth or his general drunkenness during conception were to blame for her son's disability, but she knew firsthand by the age of 16 the ills of 19th century marriage laws, which made it difficult for her to separate from her neglectful, money-squandering husband. In San Francisco, she took a job as a cigar girl, but was too blushing, modest, and sensitive for the job, so she started making dresses for an actress named Anna Cogswell. Then, hoping to make more money, she took up acting herself.
One night, while on the boards, clad in a pink silk dress and slippers, acting in the ballroom scene in The Corsican Brothers, suddenly a spirit voice addressed her, saying,
"Victoria, come home! Victoria, come home!"
It was the spirits mediated through Tenny who had come to fetch Victoria home. Tenny was in bad shape. She had been working as a healing medium, a profession Victoria was about to take up in Indianapolis. But her father, Reuben Buckman Claflin, or Buck,
I don't think I like that name,
was trading on Tenny's success to market his own miracle cures, which included lye as a remedy for cancer. In one particularly horrible case,
I'm sorry, Rob, did you say lie as in like lies? Like he was lying to people?
Like, you don't really have cancer.
No, lie is like a... It's like a chemical.
Oh.
It eats through your skin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh, yikes.
That's not good.
Burns
either.
The flesh off of your body. So he
but
was saying,
it'll get rid of cancer.
It
would get rid of you.
It's indiscriminate in what it gets rid of, I guess.
It ends the cancer, I guess.
It gets rid of something.
It gets
Side
rid of
effects
yeah.
also ends your life.
It dissolves you, so then, yes, you don't have cancer
there's
anymore.
There's nothing left.
He sounds
right.
like a criminal.
Including not cancer.
Yeah, he was a snake oil salesman, but, like, even worse, because it didn't just not hurt you, it burned your flesh off.
You win some, you lose some.
So he was run out of several towns.
Come one, come all, to Reuben Buckman's Miracle Medical Spectacular Show.
Ooh, yes.
Yes. Now I will show you all of my medical supplies. Can I have a volunteer? Is ooh, someone? Ooh, does someone have any ailments?
Pick me.
Ah, miss. Yes, you. Yes, you.
Me. Yes.
Yes.
Please.
What can I help you with?
Okay, sir. So I've been very concerned lately.
I'm concerned for you.
Yes, thank you. I am going on a. I'm 50-ish years old.
50-ish.
She doesn't even know her age.
You don't need to get details. But I have all my baby teeth.
All of your baby teeth.
I never got my adult teeth. They're just baby teeth.
That's
and
terrifying.
I can't look right at it.
I don't want to open. Okay, that's not the only thing, okay?
Oh, my.
Guys, I have many more ailments, okay?
Like tell me them. Tell me, what can I help
with?
When
I close my eyes, I see cats.
You see
cats? That's all I see.
That's terrifying.
Cure this woman.
Yes.
You came at the right time.
Something must be done.
This is fate. All right, now, I will help you. Are you willing?
Yes, yes.
All right, are you ready?
Oh, yeah. All
right, we'll take this one. I'm just going to pour it onto all of your ailments.
All of them.
You gotta fix those teeth, though.
Right.
Yes.
Make sure it gets on the teeth.
I just need you to smile for me.
Main concern.
Okay. I'm gonna need you to smile for me at first.
Oh.
As I
What's happening?
She's cured.
That doesn't look good at all.
Where'd she go?
We probably shouldn't follow her.
Yeah, it smells terrible.
Would anyone else like to try a miracle?
Victoria used her healing mediumship to raise money to help her sister. Tilton says Victoria made nearly $100,000 as a healing medium. That would be like a lot of thousands of dollars. I can't do the math.
Yeah, back in 1860s?
1872.
1872.
$100,000. That's got to be like times what? Like 100 at least?
Yeah, that's the price of a presidential campaign probably.
Hot damn. Which was probably a big exaggeration, right? But she used the money not for a presidential campaign, but to rescue Tenny from their father. Right around this time, she met her second husband, Colonel James Harvey Blood, who had served on the Union side in the Civil War and was a prominent spiritualist in St. Louis. She promptly divorced Canning and moved with Colonel Blood and her two children and Tenny to New York. In New York, Victoria and Tenny continued practicing as mediums, and Tenny acquired arguably the wealthiest man in the country, Cornelius Vanderbilt, as her client. There's a lot of insinuation and subtext, not from Tilton, but from other historians, suggesting that Tenny's healing touch may have gone a bit beyond just healing with Commodore Vanderbilt, because he decided to front the money for Tenny and Victoria to go into business as Wall Street's very first female stockbrokers. So are these rumors that Tenny had to sleep with the Commodore in order to get the backing for their stock brokerage just an extension of the belief that women use their sexuality to get ahead? Or do we think there's something to this?
Well, for one, I think it's totally fine. If you want to have a sugar daddy, you get that sugar daddy. That's your right. But
that's some third wave feminism right there.
Well, that's just Olivia things.
I mean, like, I guess it's possible that could have happened that she, but how are we supposed to know what her intentions are? Just because I feel like it's just a rumor because she was a woman.
I mean, like, I think that's a very good
powerful woman who a lot of people probably had problems with. I mean, she was one of the first in her field to make that kind of money, to go on Wall Street and to do some other things.
Yeah, I think that's part of the push and pull. So on the one side, yeah, if women don't have opportunities, like Olivia's saying, use sex. If that helps you get ahead and you have these ambitions, why should we look down on them for it? But on the other hand, we don't know what a woman's doing privately in the 19th century. We're just making guesses, and those guesses may be based on our assumptions about what women are capable of without using sex.
There's a good chance she just was very good at what she does, and she convinced this dude, like, give me your money to do this. And he was like,
okay.
Hell yeah.
He was super like, rich. Yeah, I'm sure he was used to investing in things. Maybe he just wanted to invest in them.
Or maybe she just liked the guy.
Maybe they just had a good relationship.
Maybe she just enjoyed his company. Why does it have to mean anything else?
Well, he was not a young man at this point.
But if he looked at her and saw, like, this is a young, dedicated woman that, like, is more driven than most men that I see, then, like, I would back that.
I'm going to help her out.
All right, so, James, I think that at this juncture, Vanderbilt is a guy who we could use to hear more about, because he's playing a major role in the advancement of these women. He's one of those guys like Morgan and Rockefeller you hear the name of a lot, but most people don't know much about him, except the fact that he was rich at some point and got his name on some stuff.
You want me to tell you his story?
I would like you to give us a brief history of Cornelius Vanderbilt.
Of course.
Delightful.
This is a brief history of the life and times of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt was born on a farm in Staten Island in 1794, which would have made him about 75 at the time he met Victoria and Tenny, and more than 40 years older than the sisters. At 16, he made a deal with his mother to plant 8 acres of corn in exchange for $100, and bought a ferry boat to bring passengers back and forth between Staten Island and Manhattan.
I would like one ferry boat, please.
That'll be $100, son.
I'll give you 95.
He made a boatload of money during the War of 1812, ferrying soldiers and supplies for the army. By the age of 21, he was running his own freight business. He became an expert on steamships and invested early in the transition from sails to steam. After gold was discovered in California...
Gold! It's gold, I tell you!
Woo-wee!
He began moving miners between New York and San Francisco and earned his nickname, the Commodore. While traveling with his family on his private yacht in Europe in 1853, he left his company in the hands of two men with power of attorney. They proceeded to sell themselves a controlling interest in the company.
That'll show, old Vanderbilt!
Yeah, crazy old coot.
When Vanderbilt came back, he didn't sue them. He turned his yacht into a passenger vehicle and ran them out of business.
Aw, shucks. Old Vanderbilt showed us.
That crazy old coot.
In 1864, at the age of 70, he focused his efforts on Wall Street, buying up controlling interest in a series of railroads and consolidating them into the New York Central and Hudson River Railroads, which made him the richest man in America. Vanderbilt was a man of deep contradictions, and like most rich people, could be a real jerk.
Yeah, that's for sure.
He created illegal cartels to set the prices for goods, stopped all rail traffic into and out of New York to settle business dispute, and manipulated stock prices. And he had his wife committed to an asylum for 2 years when he disagreed with her. He was a hard-swearing, rags-to-riches kind of guy who was not often welcome in polite New York society. He was even known to pummel a couple of people he found irritating until they fell unconscious.
Stop being such a moron!
But he also made big donations to worthy causes, including what's now called Vanderbilt University and the Union Army. During the Civil War, he donated his $900,000 ship, the Vanderbilt, to the Union cause to oppose the ironclad Confederate Merrimack. So I guess you've got to take the good with the bad.
As with anyone.
And that's a brief history of the life and time of Cornelius Vanderbilt.
Nice job, James.
Thank you. Guess you could say he Vanderbilt his own empire. All right. Brandon's not here, and it felt like a pun.
You could say that.
He wasn't an emperor, though.
He was not an emperor.
I mean empire as in a good old-fashioned American empire.
Trading at least in part on Vanderbilt's advice, Tenney and Victoria survived a major panic at the markets, the Black Friday of 1872, and their reputation skyrocketed. There's a great story from this period where Victoria and Tenney are dining together at Delmonico's, one of the fanciest restaurants in the city. One of our members of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors, Brianna, Olivia's sister, and I actually took a little field trip to Delmonico's circa 1872. So let's go ahead and listen in on our experience there. These are some real dishes that were served at Delmonico's back in the day.
Welcome to Delmonico's fine dining restaurant.
Yes, we're delighted to be
Thank
here.
You.
Today's specials include pigeon's compote,
like the
pork griskins.
Griskin?
Yes. A griskin.
Mock turtle.
Is there a real...
Fake.
Duck a la mode.
On ice cream. Ducks on ice cream.
Oh, no, this is a dinner entree, sir.
Larded
oysters.
In the fat.
Florentine of rabbits. Cod sounds.
What is... Cod sounds?
Yes, ma'am. They are like little turkeys.
Cod sounds like little turkeys.
Pompadour cream.
I
stewed
use that
cardoons.
In my hair.
Cardoon?
Yes, as a chef's special. Snipes in savory jelly.
Do you have anything else in savory jelly?
Yes, we have crawfish in savory jelly.
This
is very good. Potted lampreys.
Is that a lamprey in a pot, or does the pot go on the lamprey?
It's one of our more refined dishes.
Oh.
Roast woodcocks. Burnt cream.
Do you have any unburnt cream?
Unfortunately, there are no alterations to the menu. I'm sorry. Pickled smelts,
really
sheep's rumps and kidneys and rice. Lamb's ears forced.
Is forced off the lamb.
Yes, it is to die for, sir. Ox palates and transparent soup.
You mean hot water?
It's the soup of the day, is transparent soup.
So it just so happens that as we were sitting there in Delmonico's in 1872 on our time-traveling adventure, ordering from what I presume was James's great-great-great-grandfather, in comes Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin. Now, this is a true story. Not the time-travel stuff, but Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin, the sisters, did do this thing in Delmonico's that we're about to narrate for you.
Two soups, please.
In the 1870s, women weren't allowed to eat out without a male companion. So the manager came up to ask when their gentleman companion would be joining them. They said they were dining alone.
Two soups, please.
The manager was scandalized and said they would have to leave.
Leave!
So Tenny went outside and got their cab driver and brought him in and sat him down.
So, am I gonna have to pay for this? Try to sit here?
Three soups, please.
Victoria and Tenny used the money they were making as stockbrokers to fund a newspaper, the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. They published accounts of spiritualist trance lectures and reviews, including the infamous criticism of Emma Harding Britton's Art Magic, as well as socially radical editorials and reports. They advocated for women's rights and workers' rights. They published the first English translation of the Communist Manifesto, and they got tangled up with a social reformer named Stephen Pearl Andrews, a major advocate for marriage reform and free love. Woodhull traded her newly prominent position for a role in the women's rights movement, and through some clever backdoor dealing, managed to get an invitation to speak to a congressional committee on the subject of women's right to vote. This was something none of the major suffragists, led by people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, had been able to do. The argument she made was a novel one. Most suffragists were arguing for a new amendment, allowing women the right to vote. But Woodhull said that the 15th Amendment had already guaranteed women the right to vote, and no additional legislation need be passed. The 15th Amendment had been passed after the Civil War, and was intended to allow black men the franchise.
The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
The language of the amendment says that the right of citizens to vote shall not be denied, and this is what Woodhull focused on.
I hereby call this meeting of the Judicial Committee to order. We will be addressed by Mrs. Victoria Woodhull on the subject of women's suffrage.
I didn't realize the congressman was from Texas.
Women, white and black, belong to races, although different races. A race of people comprises all the people, male and female. The right to vote cannot be denied on account of race. All people included in the term race have the right to vote unless otherwise prohibited.
If women were citizens, then their right should be guaranteed. Simple as that. The argument didn't fly, though. But the fact that she was able to make it to Congress at all thrust Woodhull into the middle of the women's rights movement. They accepted her, but reluctantly. To begin, Woodhull had an upstart quality to her that rubbed the established leaders of the movement the wrong way. And then there was all that free love talk she got up to. It's around this time that Woodhull started her speaking engagements and was subsequently nominated by the Equal Rights Party to be their candidate for president. She ran alongside the great abolitionist and speaker Frederick Douglass, but by all accounts, he may not have even known or cared that he'd been nominated. Like the congressional address, the candidacy went nowhere, but it caused a stir, kept Woodhull in the spotlight, and pushed her progressive agenda, which revolved around the fair treatment of women.
Can we talk about free love for a second? This isn't the same free love from the 1960s and 70s, right?
No, this is a different approach to free love. Yeah, we're going to talk about it at length. But just briefly, it's about people being allowed to divorce to begin. But it's a bunch of other things. We'll get there.
Okay.
Divorce is not love.
Okay.
But it's free.
Real?
We, the members of the Equal Rights Party, do hereby nominate Mrs. Victoria C. Woodhull as our candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Yeah! Woo!
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
As you well know, I am not much given to the habit of conforming to convention. The whole surface of humanity is surging like the billows of the stormy ocean, and it only escapes general and destructive rupture because of its composition.
Right.
Like the consciences of its constituent members is so elastic. But anon, the restrained furies will overcome the temper of their fastenings, and rendering them asunder will sweep over the people, submerging them or cleansing them of their gathered debris.
What up, President? 3 years later, in 1875, she would be touring around the country, delivering one of the last major speeches of her public career. She'd refer to that speech, and the system within it, as the culmination of all her work as a medium and social reformer up to that moment. Her spirits had guided her to deliver unto humanity an elixir of life. So to set the scene, between the 1872 presidential run and the time she's touring around with this speech, Woodhull has become one of the most controversial women in the country. Her audiences are comprised of both fans and hate watchers, some of which even attempt to argue with her as she speaks.
Lately, when Miss Woodhull was to lecture at Newburgh, a Baptist minister prayed at a public meeting that some grand catastrophe, some breaking of a bridge or collision on a railroad might prevent this Satan from entering
their Eden. Miss Woodhull possesses a voice, an enunciation, and a manner that would have made her a fortune upon a tragic stage. At times she grows terribly earnest and fires off her words as if they were red-hot and unpleasant occupants of her mouth.
Frequently, Tenney would open for her sister. In 1875, she would often perform a monologue from Macbeth.
The raven himself is hoarse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan under my battlements. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty.
I find you sexually attractive.
And then Woodhull would emerge and go straight for the footlights.
To what does modern marriage amount, if it be not to hold sexual slaves who otherwise would be free? The repressions of law and a pretended public opinion, and the resulting enforced and unwilling relations in marriage are already yielding their natural fruit, a growing disgust sexually between the sexes. For my part, I do not care what that remedy may be. I do not care if it be promiscuous sexual intercourse for both sexes in all ages. I do not believe it possible for a woman to produce her best child except by the man whom she loves best and for whom she has had the keenest sexual desire.
Woodhull is a quintessential free lover. James was asking about this a little bit ago, and it came up briefly in our Sex Magic episode in the last series. Divorce laws are all over the map at this period, but they tend in the direction of keeping a woman from being able to easily separate from her husband, regardless of how terrible he might be to her or her children.
That's wrong.
I agree, James. As far as sex is concerned, there is no such thing as marital rape in the 1870s. A woman's body belongs to her husband, and he can force himself on her however and whenever he chooses. Woodhull is an extremist on this front. She believes a woman or a man should be able to dissolve a marriage at any time without consequence. We don't even have that kind of system right now.
She's like way ahead of her time, like ahead of our time.
Yeah, I mean, divorce today, you can pretty much divorce someone for almost any reason, but that doesn't make the divorce process easy.
Yeah.
No, and it costs a lot of money.
Yeah, it's very expensive, and there are all kinds of financial consequences, and you frequently need to hire a lawyer. So divorce is still not as easy, I think, as Victoria Woodhull would have liked it to
be. I'm sorry, you keep looking at me, Rob, and I'm like, I don't know what to do.
He's pressuring you into divorce.
Yeah, his gaze is intense.
I want you to first marry.
And then divorce.
And then divorce.
Yes.
And then, see how hard it is.
Yes,
Shannon.
So I can
see how much
report back to us.
About, I need to do my research.
All right. Well, okay. Let's talk about another subject that you all may be more informed on, perhaps, than divorce. What about women's sexual pleasure? So she's talking about how women should be enjoying sex. Do we think we've moved ahead on this front?
No. Well, yes and no. I think women are a lot more active in, like, yes, I want sexual pleasure, but I feel like a lot of men are like, they don't care or notice or don't pay attention.
So women are more assertive these days.
I guess so. I guess.
Or starting to become more sort of assertive.
Yeah, I feel like it's like kind of getting brought to light that, you know, women should have pleasure during sex, but we talk about all the time about how porn, like mainstream porn, is designed. It's all about the man and like the man's perspective and just kind of taking what he wants, and it's never really about what the woman needs or what she wants.
Yeah, we're at a period where we're all fairly convinced that the female orgasm is a real thing, which incidentally, historically, we've been back and forth on, over the last, 4,000 or 5,000 years, whether or not women have orgasms. We're convinced, I think, at this point, that women do. But I agree that publicly, there's a lot of speaking out on behalf of women's right to enjoy sex. But what's happening privately, I think, is what you're getting at, Shen, and maybe not be as favorable to the vagina.
I would also add that I think that there is this already in place idea that when, because of this whole, like what we've been talking about, like with the woman's orgasm, I think women from a young age have been like, from the first point they start having sex, is like, you become resigned to this idea of like, well, nothing's going to happen for me, but I'm going to lie to him and tell him that it did happen, because males' egos are very, very sensitive when it comes to that stuff. So it's like we've gotten to this habit, and then for a woman to be like dating someone new and be like, no, like I'm nowhere close. They're like, what? What do you mean? I've done this with hundreds of other women, maybe not hundreds. That's a lot, but like, you
ladies,
know what I'm
if
saying?
If you're with a man and he says he's been doing it with hundreds of other women,
okay, hundreds.
Put your pants on and walk out the door.
Hundreds was much, a little much, but like, you get what I'm saying. It's this ingrained societal thing now.
No, it is, and like even like in mainstream jokes and. All this stuff that, like, you hear, like, oh, women don't have orgasms, like, all this thing. Like, it's just, like, everybody's like, oh, it doesn't happen. And it's, like, but it does. It's, like, women are allowed and should also have orgasms when having sex.
Snaps.
I don't know. This issue makes me mad because I remember I saw actually someone on YouTube the other day. He was reading an article and he was like, it said women deserve orgasms. And he was like, oh, women deserve orgasms? Like, that women deserve that? And I'm like, yeah, they do, because men get it. So why don't women get it? Like, what the heck? Like, it made me mad because it's like, what?
The controversy rages on, right? All the way from 1872. Woodhull said that women's freedom is in service of women's pleasure, and this cuts both ways. Men are similarly entitled to be married to women they love and to enjoy sex with those women. There's a smattering of eugenics in the mix here. Woodhull believes that bad sex between unloving partners actually produces disabled children. This, after all, is her life experience, if you think about her situation with Byron. The same idea comes out of Pascal Beverly Randolph's views on sex magic with a more positive spin. He's advocating how to generate the best children. She's preventing against generating what she considers to be deprived children. But this whole idea fits into a much larger spiritual occultist frame. The big picture is that women's sexual slavery and the loveless, pleasureless sex that has resulted are preventing an apocalyptic shift, lifting humankind into a melding with the spiritual spheres. The spirits have been guiding Woodhull toward this ultimate revelation. Good sex generates a spiritual energy that will actually open the doors for the spirit's physical return to Earth. And bad sex has been keeping that energy from forming and keeping the door closed against them, which I guess explains why we have yet to see them.
That's kind of amazing. I love this.
Now, what does the resurrection, of which so much is said in all so-called holy, because inspired writings, mean? Simply a return to a physical life, as thousands of spirits have been endeavoring to do for the last few years, and only partly and unsatisfactorily, at best, succeeding. The spirits are coming back to tear your damned system of sexual slavery into tatters and consign its blackened remnants to the depths of everlasting hell. I tell you, they will walk into your families and claim as their loves those who are held as slaves and carry them off before your very eyes.
Yeah, basically she's saying if your wife isn't enjoying sex with you, a spirit is going to walk into your house and sex her better than you ever will.
Oh, hell yes.
The spirit's return in the form of psychic mediumship dating back to the Fox Sisters is meant to blossom into a total convergence of spirits and humans. And if you're not being good to your woman, well, then you're in for it.
Can, like, people say that to, like, their partners? Like,
like, right now? Like, you can.
As a threat? Like, in
it's bed. Like, hey, I'm just saying, if you don't pleasure me, some, like, spirit's going to do it. So, like...
Yeah, I'm going to get it where I have
I'm going
to
gonna win in the end. So
I think, Shannon, that you should say that.
Yes.
I think that's your right as a woman. For our listeners at home, James just received a knowing look. From Shannon. Now I'm going to ask our listeners to bear with us a bit because I'd like to take us down a little rabbit hole. This is not Woodhull's first lecture on this subject. In fact, it is her second. But it's a lot more comprehensible for the average person than the earlier one, which she called Breaking the Seals or The Key to the Hidden Mystery. Now this is sounding more up our occultist alley. She argued that there was a Kabbalistic key to the Bible, which would allow humans to discover the secret to eternal life through sexual union. The key revolved around an allegorical interpretation of the Genesis story in which the Garden of Eden is actually the human body, with the rivers representing the various passages through the body. The Euphrates being the channels of reproduction, and the Tree of Life is also inside the body if we can only figure out how to access it by changing our perspective on the reproductive channel. So the Tree of Life meaning the secret to eternal life.
In the new heaven and earth, which are the new man and woman, to whom there shall be no more death, both the tree and the river of life, the male and female elements, must be present, not as men and women merely, but as sons and daughters of God.
This is fascinating stuff, thinking about witchcraft and the curse of Eve. Woodhull is attacking the central Christian line of thought that's brought about all the religious and sexual marginalization of women for thousands of years.
I do think it's interesting that she's comparing the Garden of Eden to, like, the body. I really like that. Because, I mean, like, people... I mean, the Bible is a metaphor. I mean, I don't really know much about the Bible, I'll be honest. But I think that's a really interesting metaphor, and I really enjoyed that.
Right, well, so, but if you think about Christianity's medieval and early modern perspective on women... It's that they suffer the curse of Eve, and so they are the ones that are tempting and causing all of the sexual sinning that's happening in the world. They're weaker,
the
all that sort of stuff.
Sin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are the sinners. They're the drivers of sin.
Because Leviticus is sexist.
Because Leviticus yeah. is sexist. I hate that guy.
Yeah. Hashtag yeah. Leviticus is sexist.
But now here she's saying that we need to liberate both men and women and to liberate the female element. What we've been doing through all history is repressing the female element, and that's what's making us all miserable. We've got to put Woodhull in conversation with John Humphrey Noyes now. Noyes ran a small commune of what he called perfectionists in Oneida, New York, where they manufactured silverware and practiced coitus interruptus.
It's my favorite Harry Potter
edging?
Spell.
Interruptus.
Yes, James, that's kind of. Yeah, kind
Where
of. You would. It's pulling out.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He could have just said that.
Ejectus ejaculatus.
Noyes believed that the second coming of Christ had already come and gone, shortly after the lifetime of Jesus of Nazareth, which was actually the belief of Jesus' disciples, that he would be coming and going in their lifetime. For the second time, yeah. And heaven had been established on earth. But we missed it. So Jesus came and went in, like, the year 80, and we just missed it. It was like...
That is so funny to think of that actually happened. Like, wow, how we were
all
so
these
blind.
People that are still waiting, and it's like it happened, like...
Jesus is behind them waving his arms. I'm over here!
Nobody speaks that language anymore.
Here, you guys! Where is Jesus? We've been waiting.
I swore he was just here.
So Noyes says, if people would simply recognize the fact that Jesus has come and gone and established a perfect world here on Earth, we're living in a perfect world, we just don't know it, then we will be in that utopia. We'll realize that we're in the utopia, and boom, then we're there. Noyes had two big arguments around this. The second, later of the arguments, was that if heaven was established on earth, there would no longer be a division between the living and the dead. Guess who provided evidence that that was really happening? Spiritualist mediums. Oh. A grave digger. Yes. By disinterring corpses?
Yes.
Yeah, the spiritualist mediums who were communicating with the dead and literally breaking the boundary. We just hadn't been communicating with the dead, says Noyes, but we could do it all along. His first larger point was that in a perfected heavenly earth, women would no longer be cursed with the burden of childbirth, and people in general would not possess each other in any sort of monogamous sense. And this is how the commune operated, coitus interruptus. So you pulled out so that you, your sexual partner, your female sexual partner, would not have to bear children, because that's difficult. And
some would say so, yeah.
How's Katie doing?
My wife is pregnant, listeners at home. We'll be taking next month off. The other side of this is that because we're sort of free, we can have sex with as many partners as we choose. So on the commune, you would pull out of many different men and women.
Men and women.
Men, you would, if you're a woman, you would be pulled. Anyway. Pregnancy was the curse, according to Noyes, which is sort of borne out in Genesis. Now, Woodhull brought Noyes up by name. So Woodhull is name-checking Noyes in her Key to the Mysteries. And she name-checks him in order to refute this very idea. Woodhull believed that pregnancy was a beautiful and natural thing, and that a woman should look forward to it and should actually enjoy it.
Woman will never be emancipated from her slavery, utterly, until pregnancy, like other things, is governed by causative and not preventative willpower. That is to say, until children are the result of a mutual desire of both parents, and the creative act is entered upon to produce them. It will then be unnecessary to resort to unnatural methods of commerce to prevent pregnancies.
There's this idea that women will be able to will their pregnancies and no longer lose unused eggs as they do in each menstrual cycle. The whole reproductive system will follow the individual's kind of occultist will.
The Kabbalistic truth is the transforming of the fruitful river, whose waters now run in blood, into a pure river of water of life to be the healing of the nations. The way by which the creative forces in man and woman are to be utilized and made the elixir of life instead of, as they are now, the curse of death.
Now, there's some kind of secret in all this that Woodhull won't tell us about. She says you've got to read the Bible for yourself and figure it out. But basically, a reconfigured sexual union conceived in love will transform both partners and literally cause them to live forever. Any guesses how this works?
Well, let me guess. It doesn't.
So I'm confused, because wasn't she advocating that, like, you can be with whoever you want to be with? But, like, I guess I'm thinking, like, in today's, like, hookup culture, like, I guess, like, is she against birth control in a sense? Like, is she saying don't have sex with somebody unless you really, like, are in love with them?
Yes, she is. She's not really, the hookup culture, there's a lot about the 21st century that Victoria Woodhull would take issue with. And that is a big part of it. Yeah, she wants you to only be having sex with people that you feel genuine love for.
Mm.
And that's kind of essential to making sex what she's saying it should be. Literally the end of menstruation, as far as I can tell. But also the conduit of pregnancy as this sort of perfect and beautiful event.
I feel like she wasn't saying, back to what you were saying, Savannah, I don't think she was necessarily talking about birth control as being terrible as far as, like, pulling out or whatever with
Joseph Humphrey Noyes.
Yes, with Noyes. She was more kind of responding to what he was saying about pregnancy in general, how pregnancy is a curse. She was like, no, it's not. I've done it. It's cool. You should look forward to it.
Birth control is unnecessary.
Yeah. Yes.
But you have to have that connection or else the pregnancy will be, like, bad, right? Your child won't be...
It's basically just the way it is in the 19th century. So as she looks around her, people aren't engaging in these, you know, occult sexual loving relationships. Therefore, all the pain and the death in childbirth and the just discomfort of womanhood is coming out of this mm-hmm. attitude.
So she's kind of saying that if you are in a good relationship and are having good sex, then you don't have anything to worry about. You should be having that child or whatever, what happens naturally.
Yes.
And it'll be good.
I think that you'll have complete control over your reproductive system, I believe, is what she's saying. But that you should have children and live your life in this sort of very open and natural way. And it's all good. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Getting back to the Elixir of Life speech, Woodhall comes around to the social and political crusade that made her one of the most talked about people in the country.
I have already said that the spirits engaged in this movement have concentrated all their power upon a single individual, and that all the opposition has also centered there, and the fiercest of battles has been waging for the last 18 months. It was upon the point of being solved at that time, but the ignorance, weakness, and foolishness of the individual thwarted it.
This individual is none other than Henry Ward Beecher. The name should sound familiar. He's the brother to Harriet Beecher Stowe. Anybody?
Nope.
Uncle Tom's
Cabin, yeah. One of the most famous abolitionist preachers in America is Henry Ward. So the two of them are heavily associated with the cause of abolition, but we're just more familiar with Harriet Beecher Stowe because of the book. He worked from the Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, New York. Beecher used to hold mock slave auctions in his church to show both the cruelty of the system of slavery and to raise money to purchase slaves at Confederate auctions and buy them their freedom.
Hmm.
Christ then raised men from religion as a bondage to religion as a freedom. I do not like the word religion, but we have nothing else to take its place. It signifies in the original to bind, to tie. Men were bound, they were under obligations and were tied up by them. Christianity is religion developed into its last form and carries men from necessity to voluntariness, from bondage to emancipation. It is a condition of the highest and most normal mental state and is ordinarily spontaneous and free.
But Beecher was involved in an adulterous affair, perhaps one of many, with Elizabeth Tilton this time, the wife of Theodore Tilton, a close friend of Beecher's, and a member of his congregation, who you may remember from the top of the episode as the man responsible for Woodhall's biography.
Did you guys hear about the affair?
Wait, what?
It's the affair. You don't know about it?
Yeah.
What's happening? Tilton and the Beecher to Preacher.
Oh.
Elizabeth Tilton?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Hussy!
Did you guys didn't know? You haven't heard?
Elizabeth confessed the affair to her husband, who told prominent suffragist Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who in turn told Victoria Woodhall and Isabella Beecher Hooker, another of the pastor's sisters and a prominent and important figure in the women's rights movement. Henry Ward Beecher had gotten into the habit of speaking out against Woodhall's free love movement from his pulpit in Brooklyn. Ooh, bad move.
What's a pulpit?
Like a stand-in place.
So he was just his own speeches.
Like, yes. Yeah. Where you give your religious talking from.
Well, Woodhall is about to clap back.
When she discovered his hypocrisy, she confronted him with it, and he promised to drop his attacks and join her at a free love speaking engagement where he would publicly declare himself an advocate for her movement. But at the last minute, the preacher didn't show.
Wow.
Bastard.
Oh, can we say that?
Disgusted, Woodhall went straight to her weekly newspaper and published on the front page a full report of the affair. Pretty much everyone involved in this affair, including Theodore Tilton, begged Woodhall not to publish the report. But she was a woman on a mission. She believed sincerely that Beecher could have been the one to help her usher in a new era of free love, and his failure to follow through was a bitter disappointment. If Beecher had come out as a free lover, do you think we would be living in a free love utopia today?
Unfortunately, no.
No, I don't think so.
There's too many people that would be like, oh no, we can't do this. Like all the old stuck-up
Is that what they sound like? Yeah, they're all British.
The British would prevent us from having good sex.
And the racists.
The British
and the racists, which are a mutually exclusive group.
And the sexists.
Well, like, don't know, I feel like it could have definitely influenced a lot. I mean, it's hard to tell, but...
But there's a million more preachers.
It might have evolved, you know? It might have changed the way that feminism has evolved throughout...
Maybe.
Throughout the history since then.
Well, I guess back then, too, maybe it would have sounded better coming from a man, maybe?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, he was speaking from a position of more social authority and cultural capital. She was a crazy radical woman.
Mm-hmm. He's still just one man, and he has an affair attached to him now, so would everything he said just...
Yeah, but she was just one woman.
The church might...
No, but I'm saying, like...
against him, too.
Yeah.
The plan would have been for him to come out in favor of it without outing the affair. So he would have just said, I'm on board with you. She's sort of blackmailing him a little bit.
Mm.
And then the affair stays secret.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because he's practicing it anyway, was her point.
But he didn't show up, so she told you about the...
Right, so okay. She just
my type
blew
of woman.
It up. The Plymouth Church let Beecher off the hook, and it excommunicated Theodore Tilton for slandering Beecher. This made Tilton hopping mad. Hopping mad! Which you could only be in 1872.
On a scale of mad.
And he sued Beecher for alienation of affection.
What is alienation of affection? Because I'm so triggered by reading
That's
that.
That's banging my wife.
Oh.
It's adultery, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh.
That's not as bad as I thought it was.
Right, because if you're banging my wife, then you're not banging me. You're alienating her affection from
That's
me.
That's such a male term. Like, no woman would
Guys
say
like
alienating affection. That's like...
The jury failed to reach a verdict, and Beecher essentially got away with it. To this day, despite the fact that this affair was on the cover of most major newspapers for years after Woodhull broke the story... Beecher is generally only remembered for his abolitionist work and not for his opposition to free love and the scandal it caused.
Wow.
I think it's worth noting here as well that Beecher has a statue in the city of New York. Do you know who doesn't have a statue in the city of New York?
Victoria Woodhull?
Victoria Woodhull.
I got it right.
What?
Shortly after publishing about the affair, things began to go very badly for Mrs. Woodhull. She was brought up on charges of sending obscene materials through the mail. This was really a clever moment in American Puritanism. A red letter moment in the halls, the annals of American Puritanism.
Oh my God.
So the prosecution of speech, particularly in the press, was relatively well protected up until this guy, Anthony Comstock, came around with his New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, which was formed out of the Young Men's Christian Association, also known as the
YMCA
of the day. So the YMCA wasn't just where a young man could go
and dance his heart out
with all of his gay friends
in the pool
and cops and Indian chiefs. In the 19th century, it was this heavily puritanical group who sought out social reforms like the prosecution of obscenity. Comstock was actually a postal inspector, and he managed to get a series of laws passed criminalizing the content of certain materials going through the mail. These laws lasted a good long time. After the Beecher Tilton article came out, he ordered several copies of the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly under an assumed name, and then came in and busted up the Weekly's office before sending obscene material in the mail, turning it upside down. He threw Victoria and Tenney and Colonel Blood in jail for violating his law. The interesting thing is... They were prosecuted for the Beecher Tilton article. They were...
Okay. So there's a place called Beecher's Cheese in New York.
Beecher's Cheese.
Yeah, Beecher's Cheese Shop. There's... I think there's two locations. Is this the same guy?
All right, so you're saying, in your mind, Donna, that the abolitionist preacher from 1872 opened two cheese shops... That have lasted to the present day.
I'm just saying.
Maybe it was his family.
Maybe it was a family cheese.
Okay, so the Beecher family, who we've noted write novels and advocate for
Maybe
women's rights.
Maybe he had a distant cousin who was an outcast who wanted a cheese shop.
I think he was like, I'm done with this slavery shit. I just want to sell cheese.
I think that's the most accurate way to tell, like, the level of success someone has. Yeah. Like, if they have cheese shops.
It's still around today.
Two cheese shops.
Cheese shops under name. That's what I want.
One is like a cellar. It's pretty cool.
Is his ghost there?
The interesting thing is that the Victoria and Tenney and the Colonel Blood were not prosecuted for the Beecher Tilton article on the front page. They were prosecuted for a little expose by Tenney, which appeared 13 pages in. It was the story of a man named L.C. Challis, a prominent society figure in the habit of debauching young women and then discarding them at brothels to live their lives out as prostitutes. Tenney and Victoria went to spy on Challis at a high society party where he'd brought two teenage girls to entertain him and his friend. They got the girls drunk and brought them back to this brothel to continue the party.
They were taken to the house of a woman we will call Molly, a first-class house of prostitution where they were robbed of their innocence, each of these scoundrels taking one to himself. And this scoundrel, Challis, to prove that he seduced a maiden, carried for days on his finger, exhibiting in triumph the red trophy of her virginity. After a few days, these Lotharios exchanged beds and companions, and when weary of this, they brought their friends to debauch these girls, mere children.
So he kept this blood on his fingers for several days. He just left it there.
Disgusting on so many different levels.
Yeah.
Was anyone like, no, can you please wash your hands? Like, that's disgusting.
He sounds like a pretty antisocial guy.
Well, I guess
yet he's very popular with the debauchers of New York.
Well, yeah.
Well, if he kept it for so many days, that means they were giving him praise. Like, who was praising this man?
The debauchers of New York.
That's crazy. That says a lot about their culture.
It just
is
like all brown and dried up. Like,
that's terrifying that people with such power can be so corrupt and terrible.
If it makes you feel any better, it's today.
No, I mean, like, he said it's crazy how people
with such power
can be so corrupt. It's like the president of our United States, but I don't want to bring that up.
Well, yeah. Anna makes a point, though. There is a certain lack of interest in women's issues, shall we say, in a certain faction of a certain party these days.
Yep. Big sigh.
We did not name any politicians.
Right. We'll try to remain as neutral as possible here. Don't want to turn off any of our MAGA fans.
Vote for Victoria Woodhull.
Woodhull for president. I don't know what kind of a person would be MAGA and also now this many episodes into this podcast, but it could happen. I'm open to it. Wow. After being thrown in jail, Woodhull was released when her lawyer demonstrated that the Bible contained more or less the same sort of material found in Challis's article. Just for example, Abraham's nephew begetting children by his own daughters, the whore of Babylon rising from the ocean with her, 400 breasts or something.
Too many.
And he wondered if every Bible distributor should be imprisoned based on Comstock's law. Then she was jailed again on charges of libel, now from Challis. This is really an incredible moment in American history. Woodhull knew the cops were coming for her, but she had a speech to deliver that night on the conditions in the Ludlow jail, talking about the criminal justice system and the injustices that were being done against her through the state. So a whole crowd gathered, and the cops gathered there too. And they waited, whispering over whether or not the great lady would show and get herself arrested.
Well, I don't want her to get arrested.
No, look over there.
It's like our own version cops.
I really hope so. I really want to see her.
This little hunched over old lady started making her way through the crowd, and folks started to move aside to let her through out of respect for her age. And when she got to the front, she leapt up on stage, threw off the shawl she'd wrapped around her head, and there was Victoria Woodhull in all her glory. The excited crowd closed in around her, so the cops couldn't get to her, and she delivered her address.
That's awesome. So theatrical.
Jim, you go around the other side there. We gotta get around this crowd here.
Please.
No, they can't arrest her.
Please, we're under arrest.
No.
Please disperse.
This woman is under arrest. Yes, the crowd has got to disperse.
Let me
know. What is disperse?
Little girl.
My friends and fellow citizens, I come into your presence from a cell in the American Bastille, to which I was consigned by the cowardly servility of the age. In my person, the freedom of the press is assailed and stricken down, and such has been the adverse concurrence of circumstances that the press itself has tacitly consented, almost with unanimity, to this sacrilegious invasion of one of the most sacred of civil rights.
The triumphant moment would be one of Woodhull's last. Comstock's thugs had destroyed most of her property. The two trials had put a significant strain on her cash flow, and she was forced out of public life. She divorced Colonel Blood on amicable terms, and the Commodore's son gave Victoria and Tenney some money to sail for England, where they both started over. They married British nobility, and although Victoria made a second, entirely symbolic run for president from England, her time on the American public stage had come to a close.
That is so sad.
I think she started it as a cigar girl.
I know. You too, if you could just take a job as a cigar girl and work your way up.
When you said it, I was like, dream job.
That's the ground floor right there. But yeah, that's the fate of any radical. She's on the edge. She's on the fringe. She caused a stir, and you can only do that for so long.
Well, she kind of went out with a bang.
The new element that the spirits require for the purposes of more effective and permanent materializations is a spiritualized sexual aura to be exhaled by the perfect blending of the sexes in the highest and divinest relations known to humanity. The conditions requisite to develop this element reside without question in many individuals, many pairs of individuals, and without doubt, various temporary exhibitions of the perfect unity of these conditions have occurred, which, had there been unlimited freedom in their existence, might, ere this, have evolved what is required. Hence, the triumph over slavery in all its forms must be before these conditions can be and continue.
All right. So that's Victoria Woodhull. How can we think about her in conversation with all of the other lady magicians we have been talking about so far?
Well, first of all, she's a powerful woman that people actually listen to.
Powerful and radical for that, or rather her power comes from being radical.
Yeah.
So thinking about like the Maenads running off to the forest, Marie Laveau challenging the structure of New Orleans society, that sort of stuff. What else are we seeing as far as themes here?
She was a woman of firsts.
Okay.
Yeah, first newspaper, first Wall Street, first spiritual activist, first women to run for president.
Yeah, and the supernatural sort of almost giving her permission to do these things. As a trance medium, we talked about this during our American Occult series, but women weren't really allowed to speak in public. But when they were speaking in trance, they weren't speaking as themselves. So it gave them permission to get up in front of an audience and channel these otherworldly forces. And this sort of opened the door. But the interesting thing about Woodhull is, while she claimed to be a trance speaker, she frequently put down her script and all this sort of stuff. So she spoke as herself. She used the supernatural and worked through the supernatural to advocate a message that was socially progressive and radical and to sort of garner this authority.
Yeah, I would say that I think she almost takes it a step further than, like, other women we've been talking about, because she does kind of drop, like you said, like, she doesn't rely so much on her, like, spiritualist, like, trance abilities to get attention as a woman. She kind of took it and then upped the ante even more by, like, not rejecting that, but putting that aside a lot of the times and speaking as herself. So I think she, like, took it a little bit farther, I guess.
Where Marie Laveau was pretty much a New Orleans phenomenon.
Mm. Yes.
You know, Victoria Woodhull was a national phenomenon.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she's a white woman, so we have to bear that in mind, too. So her ability to speak and travel is it's easier to come by, I think, than someone like Marie Laveau. Mm. But as part of a spiritualist lecture circuit, Emma Harding Britton was doing the same thing. They're going around from town to town, city to city, sharing these lectures that, you know, they've conceived theoretically by or through the spirits. So she does have a bigger megaphone. I think the other thing I think about in terms of Victoria Woodhull and the message that she's sharing, for me, she sort of starts a spiritualist. She goes on this political journey that seems to dissociate from spiritualism and occultism, but then at the end she loops back onto it again. And she blends her radical social program of women being able to divorce and enjoy sex, weird and crazy times, with her spiritual message that, you know, we can usher in this apocalyptic shift in the universe and change the way our souls function by achieving this social change.
I think she's a woman that a lot of other women today would easily be able to, like, hear and connect to. Like, even though she is from, like, a different time period, she's so, like, I guess, like, proactive in the way that she thinks that, like, to me, like, someone like a woman now, it's like, it still stands as like...
No, I totally 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't think she's very well remembered.
No.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea about her running for president until you told us one day. Like, that blew my mind. Like, no one has ever said that ever in any class.
Some people, or some critics, will say that she wasn't necessarily the first woman to run for president because I think she was too young anyway. She was like 34. She was a year younger than
she would have turned 35 after the election.
Yeah.
But before her inauguration. So she would have been old enough to be president, but she wasn't at the time old enough to run for president.
Did we mention her running mate, her VP?
Yes, Freddie Douglas, yes, yeah.
Frederick Douglas. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you think people would, like, mention her?
Yeah.
Because of that, even? Like,
I mean, well, he didn't know that he was running for VP.
Well, still. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's attached to all these, like, bigger names in some way, but yet I went through all of my education until college never hearing her name.
I think it's pretty common that the most radical voices tend to be drummed out of history and drummed out of the narrative. And, wow. I mean, that's occultism, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why we're here, to bring these folks back and give them the spotlight they have always deserved.
It's fine. I'll just run for president. I'll bring back occultism into politics.
Good luck.
Thanks, Savannah.
In the meantime, Olivia, can you go ahead and bring us on home?
I hereby adjourn and call closed?
You declare it closed.
Oh.
You always have trouble
I always forget. Like, yeah. I don't know what it is. I hereby adhern and declare closed this meeting of...
We're the secret order.
The secret order of alchemical actors yes. Until such a time as we get together and I maybe remember and do it again.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yep.
So we had Olivia here reading for Victoria Woodhull today, and Savannah Verrett was reading for Tenny Claflin. Thank you very much. We had Jacob Wheatley as Theodore Tilton and the Commodore, and we had Brandon Walls as Henry Ward Beecher, and James Kaplangis played our manager at Delmonico's. Joining us in discussion, Shannon Landers and Anna Pavone.
Hello.
Hi.
Or bye.
Bye, friends.
There's always so much tension when you have to say goodbye. Everyone wants to say hello.
Because like, we don't want to leave, you guys.
Bye.
We want to remind you, if you could be so kind, since you've made it this far in the episode, to kindly review us and give us as many stars as you think we deserve.
Unless it's bad, then, you know.
Then it's weird that you've listened to this whole thing.
We only want good stars.
Visit us on Patreon, if you could be so kind. $1 a month would be more than enough to encourage us. And we just need a little bit of encouragement.
We could buy so many things.
We could buy so many things.
Like food.
Visit us on Facebook. Go to our website, www.occultconfessions.com, or our Twitter handle.
Which is at Podcast Occult.
All right. We will catch you next time, where we're going to have a very special episode of Occult Confessions in which we explore the history of Wicca, and ooh. Olivia demonstrates a little Wicca ritualization for us.
You want money? I'm going to help you get that.
Join us for the prosperity doctrine of Wicca next time on Occult Confessions. Thanks.